All right. So the whole question of reconciling Jewish and Greek here, and I made that sort of the big idea, that phrase that Paul uses three times in Romans, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. The importance of this will be clearer as we go on. Context is one of the hugest things that we're talking about here, because obviously in the first century, even though the first believers were all Jewish, nevertheless, at the rate that Paul was going and his passion to bring the message to the Gentiles, the question of contextualization into the Greek was an enormous question. A lot of times people will say that Greek religion was compatible with philosophical inquiry because its gods weren't really that suffocating, so there was room for questioning. Yet the Jewish idea of Yahweh was all-encompassing and ruled over everything and defined everything. Anything the Greeks got their hands on then was open to a healthy amount of questioning. And so allegory was one of the things that was called for. Philo, for example, I would use that example yesterday, of a Jewish philosopher who was trying to get them to allegorize the Old Testament text to make it more compatible with the development of rational thought in the world. It would make it less embarrassing and more palatable to the Greeks. And so the missionary's task in taking the gospel to the pagan was context. And usually that meant philosophical context in the first century. That's always a misleading question. First of all, the Corinthians are a case in point, if you want a biblical example of this. They prized eloquence in speech. That's pretty obvious from what Paul is saying in his first letter to the Corinthians. Ultimately, they loved that sort of thing because rhetoric was seen as the culmination of a superior philosophy of life. But if we remember that Greek philosophy had turned inward by this time, cynicism, that kind of refined speech was nothing but demagoguery and self-inflating. So the Apostle Paul would have none of it, and he let the church in Corinth know that this would be an error that was basic to all of their other arrogant behavior. So, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, he contrasts his speech with theirs by saying this, "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." So, however all these bad pagan ideas may have needed to be overcome, the most underrated fact of Greek thought leading up to the time of Christ was just how much its philosophy decimated its old religion. So philosophy, in the hands of God's providence, decimated the thought system of the devil through his power structures and their old religion. Now for 20 centuries following that time, people knew this. It was certainly a feature of Augustine's argument. Whatever else may be false in classical philosophy, the fact of the matter is that for 5 centuries leading up to Christ, the old demonically inspired pantheon of gods was whittled, cut by cut, down to size, so that the individual Gentile was still oppressed by demons and their domain, but the old thought system was teetering. The idea here, people are getting cynical all the way leading up to Christ, is that the idea of worldview was an old, naive pipe dream. And world order, or society, or ethical behavior, was disintegrating with it. So people, in one sense, were turning inward, and the only philosophies they ever wanted to hear about were things that they could make themselves have a better life. Better life now. There were philosophies of it at that time. But at the same time, they knew that there was all irrational, so people were crying out for a truth. So there's a lot of similarities. You know, people talk about the similarities between the fall of Rome and the argument Augustine was making, and that's true. But there's a lot of similarities between where European man is now, an American man, postmodern man, and where the cynical Greek was leading up to the time of Christ. And what's the answer to that? It's not to ask them more questions, it's to get an answer to them. So, as we look at the Jewish and the Greek message together, it's sometimes said, here's one secular historian of Christianity that I've been reading, McCullough, his book Christianity, it's often said that Christianity is nothing but the result of, quote, a dialogue between Judaism and Greco-Roman philosophy. So Christianity, a dialogue between Judaism and Greco-Roman philosophy. Now, however that may have characterized the earliest theologians and systematizers, it says very little about the message itself. What was the central message of the earliest Christians? Was there a distinctly Jewish Christian message and a distinctly Greek Christian message? Certainly there is a cultural tension that you can see playing out in the book of Acts, and it's strongly suggested in several of the epistles, especially in the book of Galatians. But do those Jew-Gentile tensions represent something essential to a hybrid nature of Christianity? Or is it more likely that these tensions are reactionary, the consequence of false assumptions brought in from these two cultures to mix unnaturally with the singular Christian message? Now, believing scholars have never been unaware of the tension between the gospel and the existing thought streams already in the world, but they've tended to see the tension as being fundamentally between Christian truth and all other worldly thought. Here's one example. In his book, New Testament Survey, Merrill Tenney wrote that Christianity did not begin its growth in a religious vacuum in which it found people blankly waiting for something to believe. On the contrary, the new faith in Christ had to fight its way against entrenched religious beliefs that had been in existence for centuries. What's going on here is a battle between what's bigger, in a sense. Where do I put this? I'm going to erase all this. What's bigger, the cultural, natural? You see how even here, evolutionary dogma plays a role in the formulation of things. They're trying to explain the formulation or the creation or the genesis of Christianity. And all they can think of is this evolving process in which the ideas of one developing culture and the ideas of another developing culture start intertwining and creating this thing that, in a sense, then is smaller than this overall process. It's a part of it. Okay? So you see, there's an unbelieving assumption. There's an entire worldview, an anti-Christian worldview is leading into that thesis. It, for lack of a better phrase, it's a cultural concoction thesis. Christianity was the concoction of the evolution of these cultures. In other words, the message isn't from outside of time and space. It's from within it. Whereas a Christian worldview would draw a circle around this. It wouldn't be afraid of the things that are diverse in Greek or Jewish culture, but it would say that Christianity created these ideas to begin with. Anything good they said from the beginning were God's truths. Forget about Christian truths for a second. But the basic gist of the cultural concoction thesis varies. That's what's so slippery about it. Sometimes if a person that says, hey, I'm not a Christian, I'm just a secularist is saying it, you've got your antennas up. But if somebody is handing you a book in a seminary for church history and they're saying it, you're maybe not aware that it's an unbelieving thesis. So there have been two main groups that have toyed with this idea. First of all, there's always been outright skeptics that explain away the uniqueness of Christianity by chalking up its every element to the already existing strands of a Judaism that's too primitive to be respected and a Hellenism that's too rational for the new faith to be worthy of. So they've got to take bits and pieces from both. Secondly, there's those within theological and church circles that will inflate the abilities and the motives of the Latin church fathers to show how they hijacked the message and the movement of Jesus between the first and the fifth centuries. Naturally, this thesis is also going to inflate the value of the alternative Christianities which were arbitrarily displaced by these Latin Greek bullies. So to repeat what I said by introduction yesterday, there were such alternative Christian communities in Asia and Africa, and their lives and their story were of value. And therefore the church's mistreatment of them is utterly wicked. But that is a separate question from what doctrinal formulation is more or less in concert with the meaning of Scripture. If you ask me what is Christianity, or what is orthodoxy, to me that's a synonym for what does the Bible teach. I don't care who beat up who, or whose mommy had more money, or anything else. That's irrelevant to the question of what is the message of the Bible. What is the legitimate form of orthodoxy that should have come out of the first century? So what's happening here is a massive changing of the subject to turn us and our loyalties against orthodoxy. What this church historian really means to say, if he could speak like a man, is that those elements of early Christian theology in the West that express themselves in Greek, in philosophical forms, are by definition wrong and evil. That's what they mean to say, but they won't say it up front. In fact, such a person would state clearly, if he was honest, that the theologies excluded in the first century make up the real orthodoxy, and the ones that survived are the real heresies. That's what they mean. Now, some people like Bart Ehrman and, what's that other girl's name, Elaine Pagels, or whatever her name is, they'll come out and say it on the Hitler channel. But when they say the same thing in seminary, Christians are very slow to understand that there's another worldview getting smuggled in here. So, let me list five assumptions behind this thesis. Five assumptions. You may have heard it in seminary. You may have seen it in books. You may have never heard of any of this at all, but I guarantee you, all five of these assumptions, I'm not going to fit them in this little space. What am I doing? I'm going to do that over. Put it on the left. All five assumptions are behind virtually every book that comes out of most of the Christian publishers today on any subject.
Are you including McCullough and Gonzalez? Because McCullough is a lot of what I've read in the past, and Gonzalez is what I'm in now.
Right. Gonzalez I don't know about too much. He's a little bit from the old guard, too, even though some of the things... He's drawing attention to good things when he draws attention to other forms of Christianity. There's nothing wrong with covering those subjects. But, for one thing, Inner Varsity Press as a whole, a lot of the seminaries, and anything in missional theology, they're operating on these assumptions. The kind of things you would hear from liberal theologians in the 19th century are now standard fare in conservative circles as well. Here's assumption number one. That the God of the Jews... Watch the card trick here. The God of the Jews is personal, not immutable. Now that's not a new false dilemma. Open theism and process theology, any theology of immanence, especially coming from the 19th century, pit these things against each other. Oh boy, immutable. There we go. The God of the Jews is personal, not immutable. You know, like anything the Greeks would have had in mind by any kind of deity is immutable, this static thing. So obviously there's a hidden premise here. Namely, that the essence of personhood is change. That to the degree one is immutable, this changeless static thing, this object of intellectual reflection alone, cannot be very relatable to real people. A changeless thing is a frozen thing. Like some of the figures in Dante's Inferno, staring from eternity motionless toward the movement of real persons. So that's everywhere. You don't have to go to an open theist or a process theologian for that. That's in a lot of the books. That's in a lot of the assumptions today in evangelical circles. So false dilemma. Second assumption, that the transcendence of Christ, I'll put transcendent Christ. Is a Greek idea, not a Jewish idea. Well, no doubt, Christ's transcendence surprised the heck out of a lot of Jews that were there at the time, but not because of this reason. A transcendent Christ is a Greek Christ, and so you would often hear about high Christologies, for example, in John's Gospel, that come later, after Greek influence has taken its toll. So the concepts of Christos and the Logos show, in McCullough's words, a tangle of Greek and Jewish ideas. Tangle? What do you mean? Third, that the writing of the Jews is narrative at the exclusion of propositions, while the Greeks tended to be propositional at the exclusion of narrative. So I'll just put... propositional versus narrative. By the way, if you're keeping score, everything on the Greek side of this scoreboard would be above the line in the invisible, in the speculative, in the irrelevant orthodox land, the Western imperialistic systematizing land. where everything under the line would be earthy, relationally, holistic, communal on the Jewish side. So, propositional versus narrative. By the way, that's one of the most absurd and easy to refute tenets of this thesis. I mean, isn't all narrative propositional? Is that mine? No, because I was right there. Can you think of a story where there's a single statement that's not a proposition? Can you think of a poem that's... I mean, so you see the problem here. I mean, yes, there are things like, ouch, but I've never read a book where every single, ouch, arg, why, da, that's not a story. That's nonsense. Okay? So the idea that propositional or didactic forms of literature are alien to or other than narrative forms of... That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It's probably the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life because of the amount of taxpayer dollars that are going to pay the idiots that say it. Okay? That is not a legitimate idea on any idea of legitimate ideas. Number four. The fourth point of this thesis is that the Greek mind was set on the individual and escape from the world, while the Oriental mind, to which the Jews were closer, processed religion through the more communal ethical lens. So, intellectual seeing and the individual. So the individual's intellect seeing above Plato versus communal ethical. In other words, if you're any good for anybody, you will not think for yourself, about things you can't see. That will be inwardly driven. Now, the fifth point really follows from that fourth point, and it sets the implications for how a Greek would supposedly hear the gospel message as opposed to a Jew. And that is that the Greek citizens of the Roman Empire had a fundamentally different need in their yearning for salvation than the Jews did. So that they had, I'll just put, a different big problem. If this is your way of thinking, Greek, you're going to be looking for an escape from this world, as opposed to if you are a Jew or an Oriental thinker and reading things through the narrative about earthy things, personal things, your problem is going to be, you're going to be thinking about how do we solve the problem down here. Which means that if you're thinking above the line, you're going to get a bunch of people killed, you may make a lot of profit, but you're probably going to spread a lot of disease, famine, wars, and oppression, as opposed to if you're one of these people, you're probably going to love more people and be good for more people. That is the thesis, and it finds its root and its fountain all the way back in this chapter of church history. Another thing to keep in mind is something that ought to be obvious to a child, and that is that the apostolic circle, in other words, those who wrote the New Testament, were extremely Jewish, with the exception of Luke. They were of the Hebraic, not the Hellenistic school of Judaism. They were from Jerusalem in that neck of the woods, not Alexandria. I know they were from the woods, but compared to Alexandria, they were from the Jewish part of Judaism. And if you want to argue that they were unschooled in Greek thought, it becomes all the more difficult to lay this ingenious concoction of this synthesis at their feet. So, I'm going to skip through a couple things here. But this whole line of thinking fails to account for what the scriptures say about general revelation. And so, the Christian would draw a circle around these things. First of all, would reject this whole idea anyway. That the Greeks were thinking up there and the Jews were thinking down here. I would point you especially to their view of God. Start with their view of God. Does anybody have a more transcendent and invisible view of God than the Jews? Okay? So immediately this should violate all of our concepts of common sense here. On a Christian idea, all truth is God's truth. So that all Greek truth is Christian truth, and all Jewish truth is Christian truth. Because all truth is God's truth. If Christianity is true, then those elements of Greek thought which are true are not as Greek as they are theological. In the same way as gravity is not English because Newton described it. So on a truly biblical view of this synthesis, Jews and Greeks share in the same basic humanity under the same ultimate Lord. Therefore, their souls were made for the same thing. The problem of their world is the same sin problem. They're going to process truth in the same essential way, and the ultimate solution is going to be the same for both. This really wouldn't have been controversial in conservative evangelical circles a generation ago, but it is now. Nevertheless, there were real disparities between the two traditions. And I don't want to minimize those. There was definite community conflicts between Jew and Gentile, between Jew and Greek. And there had to have been, since the Greeks ran on the fumes of general revelation, perverted by centuries of rebellion, while the Jews were in direct contact with God himself, so specific revelation. I already talked about that, how their view of God was worlds apart. And again, it's opposite of this thesis. The Jews tended to think of God as transcendent and invisible and up there and the cause of everything, and the Greeks tended to reduce the chasm between the divine and the human. You see that in their sculpture, their architecture, certainly their plays and their myths. Because their gods are just amplified human beings with, you know, committing a lot of the sins that human beings commit. And the typical Jew in the first century really was eschatologically driven, like N.T. Wright says. And like all scholarship has always agreed to, Christians through the ages have maintained that the Jews of the first century were looking for a corporate, ethical, if not revolutionary, solution to a basically secular problem. The problem of Roman oppression. And before N.T. Wright popularized the ideas of this kind of idea, this scholarship, in the past decade or more, most evangelicals would have said the same. The difference is, most evangelicals would have ended that sentence, and that's why Jesus' first audience misunderstood him. So what N.T. Wright is saying, that we've covered in a lot of classes before, is not, on that point, is not wrong, but it's entirely irrelevant, because Christians have always understood that. Jews in the first century were expecting something a little bit more earthy, in the sense of an earthly problem and an earthly solution. That's why they butted heads with Jesus. So, the apostles did not write as people who were obsessed with these two different contexts. They understood that the two cultures were light years apart because there was an unnatural evil force called sin separating them, even though these diversities were legitimate expressions of the divine image. The apostles were not oblivious to cultural context, but neither were they unduly impressed by it. Here's another way to say it that I think is a short, sweet way to say it. They were culturally aware without being culturally anxious. We're not. We tend to be culturally anxious, and we are not culturally aware. The things that were culturally unique between Jew and Gentile were called to submit to the lordship of Christ just as much as their shared evils. What was unique about the Jew as opposed to the Greek, or unique about the Greek as opposed to the Jew, did not function as a controlling category for the apostles the way that it does for us. For Paul, what made someone more than a mere Greek and more than a mere Jew was a power, and you'll see this in 1 Corinthians 1, I'm going to read it in a second, a power that is so transcendent that nothing Greek or Jewish could hold back the soul from its light. So in Paul's mind, 1 Corinthians 1, 22 and 24, there's three people groups. There's Jew, Gentile, and then all the people God's going to take out of Jew and Gentile. And the thing that takes them out of Jewishness and Gentileness isn't something that is Jewish or Gentile. It's something that's bigger than both. So he says, for Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. So, what unifies the way that the Jews and the Greeks heard the gospel diversely is precisely that which transcends them both in that very gospel power and preaching. Any questions so far? Because I'm going to talk about six things that are in the gospel that unify the Jew and the Gentile.
You talked about cultural awareness and cultural anxiety or anxiousness.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
Well, one of those words that we throw around, over-contextualization. You ever hear that word? There's contextualization, but there's over-contextualization. And one very Greek way to solve the problem. One second. That is a long word. Wow. Look at that three times. Look at that. Is that right? All right. Good. Aristotle, in his rhetoric, I love this. This is a good way of explaining a lot of things. Developed three. What he said is that there's three elements of communication: logos, pathos, and ethos. One of them was the truth itself. One of them was the truth felt. And one of them is the truth incarnate, in a sense. In other words, knowing the truth, feeling as you should about it. If you don't, you're going to be miscommunicating it. And then knowing your audience and identifying with them. And he says communication really hasn't happened until all three of those things. Another modern way that I've heard these things described, I'm just going to talk about logos and ethos for a second, is text and context. And by context here, I don't mean the context of the Bible, for example. I mean the cultural context that you're speaking into. So if you're a missionary going to a foreign culture, you'd have to know how to speak that. You have to know their language, obviously. But then the concepts that mean things that are different in their culture than you would in yours. So this whole, especially since missional theology, there's this whole debate about contextualization. When does it become over-contextualization? Well, it becomes over-contextualization when ethos starts to bleed into logos. When it starts to suck it into its vortex. To the point where it dethrones the way the world really is in your message, the truth of the way, the message that you're charged to give starts to come unwound because of the emphasis on making it more palatable to those people. That's not a new problem, obviously. That's something that they had to deal with in the first century.
That would be realizing cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiousness.
Yeah.
Allowing, or basically, that we are over aware of other cultures.
Yeah. And there's times where you just have to put your foot down and do it a different way. For example, Paul circumcises Timothy, so he's less of a stumbling block to the Jews in Ephesus. He makes a point to not circumcise Titus, and then brings him to Jerusalem, and you see that in Galatians 2, for the purpose of starting a fight with those in Jerusalem that were compromising the gospel. So it's weird. You have two entirely opposite actions. Because, you know, it was worth it in this case. You know, there was too much contextualization going on here, in a sense, to the Jews in that case. But, at any rate, yeah, that was a serious, serious thing in the first century. So what unifies it? What really unifies it? If the apostles were not overly sweating this, if that was not defining their message, then what did? What unifies the way that the Jews and the Greeks heard the gospel diversely is exactly the gospel that stands over and above and prepared the Jewish and the Greek mind to begin with. First of all, six things. Number one, the deity or the lordship of Christ. The first reason that that's not a Jewish or Greek idea is because if Christ is God, as Paul says, is God the God of Jews only? He's not a local deity here. He's kind of the deity. And so that immediately, if you're talking about God versus everything else, well, the idea of God immediately unifies everything else because everything else falls into the category of things God made for himself. And if I find out that this Christ is God, boom, everything in Jewish culture and Greek culture immediately just shrinks to the size of a pea. By comparison, and is within God's truth and Christ's lordship. Secondly, the scandal of the saving cross. I'll just put cross. Nope. Thirdly, I'm just going to list these out, brother. I had a whole thing in my notes on all of them. I'm just going to list them out. The resurrection, the triumph of the resurrection. I mean, if you could say, as Paul did to the Corinthians, in a sense, dare people to check it out, that's not a Jewish or Greek thing. Well, the Greeks were into verification, the Jews really weren't. Well, that's nonsense. Why didn't the Jews hire people to tell people that the disciples stole the body if they didn't work with verification, if that's not the way their mind worked? Okay? So that's just one point right there. But also the resurrection solves, it gives you a view of history. The resurrection, the doctrine of the resurrection, immediately corrects Greek history that's cyclical. And as we're going to see these myths, these different, what do you call them, death and rebirth myths from the East, the resurrection completely undoes that cyclical view of history. I'm going right over it. Fourthly, the authoritative commission to disciple the world. I just put Great Commission. And this is another point that shows the superiority of Jesus over all of his other contestors. One author, Paul Meyer, in his book First Christians, talked about the Great Commission, and he says, "Such phrases forever set the New Testament apart from other books. No dying philosopher ever uttered so all-embracing a charge to his followers, nor did any world conqueror." In other words, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, therefore go and make disciples of all nations. Fifth, the gospel includes Jesus' promise of the Holy Spirit to the church. And that is specifically to fulfill that task of the Great Commission. And then sixthly, you can call it eschatology, you can call it the end, you can call it, let's just call it Christ's return. This goes hand in hand with the reason that the resurrection unified everything. This brings history to an end. And so it immediately refutes all of the other worldviews that are cyclical versus the Jewish idea of a linear history. So, it's not for the church historian to reconcile the Jewish and the Greek background so that the origin of Christianity can be explained. If Christianity is true, then both Jewish truths and Greek truths are ultimately God's truth, the God who is revealed in Jesus Christ. But there's no sidestepping that question. The answer to that question determines how church history will be read. And to somebody who is more advanced, I would say, go ahead, read this secular historian. But I would say that there's always an answer to whether or not Christianity is true assumed up front for the author, and it's going to color everything else. I'm not saying it's of no value whatsoever, but people that don't realize that and go in headlong into these books assuming an amount of indifference from these authors don't realize there's massive philosophy being dumped into your mind in every single page. Massive amounts of idea about Christianity not being the superior, at least not even being aware that it's a superior idea to other worldviews. So, one last point, and that is on these Eastern mystery cults such as Mithraism. Did they shape early Christian doctrine? The simple answer is that the claim is ignorant on two crucial facts. The similarities between these religions and Christianity are superficial where it counts the most, and a part of general revelation where it is general. In fact, C.S. Lewis even talked about what he called the queer dreams of the pagans. And he even included this myth of the corn king in that. And in fact, I was just reading in Clement's epistle to the Corinthians. He was writing from Rome in 90 A.D. He even includes the phoenix as a good example of the resurrection. I'm not sure it was a great argument, but at any rate, in the first century, people were perfectly aware of other things in nature, and they weren't shy about it. And it wasn't like in the 3rd or 4th or 5th century someone woke up and said, "Oh, they might think that Mithraism contributed to this, or Osiris and some other Egyptian or Babylonian myth. Let's keep that quiet," and stuff like that. They openly talked about how these things, just like they talked about things in nature, are things that God made. In fact, in Ecclesiastes, it says that God has put eternity in man's heart, but not so that he can tell the beginning from the end. Love that verse. Because it's one of those verses about general revelation that says that you should expect someone like Confucius, a couple hundred years before Christ, to say, "Do unto others, or do not do unto others as you would not have it done unto you." And to find Jesus saying the positive of that, "Do unto others as you would have it done unto you." We should expect everywhere people to be affirming things that are true about the Christian worldview, because they're in the Christian worldview. They just don't know it. If Christianity is true, then the most rabid atheist is always speaking God's truth against his will all the time. He's just jumbling it up in perverse complaints about God's stuff, but he always has to use God's information to do that. So these cults are perverse, demonic contortions of things that are true and always have been true, in the longing of people for a resurrection and for an idea of superhuman creatures that are doing it, because they combine the creaturely and the creator in a perverse demonic way. So we should expect these things. Several religions of endless birth and rebirth existed in the first century and before that. From Egypt, there was Isis and Osiris. From Asia, the great mother myth. And there were other similar notions celebrated along the Mediterranean as well. There's the imperial cult among the Romans, which is sort of conglomeration, and the cult of Mithra was from Persia. And its emphasis on rebirth and afterlife became the dominant myth, especially in the Roman army by the 3rd century. In fact, the Roman emperor started to put on the coin Sol Invictus, the inconquerable sun. And of course, that was the choice religion among the Roman soldiers prior to Constantine. And Constantine tried to even, I guess some of them tried to ban that, but it survived well into that century, the 4th century. But at any rate, a lot of people don't realize that these things come from the same Babylonian origins as other spin-offs from Zoroastrianism. But it's fundamentally dualistic at its circular core. In fact, the swastika, I would draw it, but I don't want to get in trouble. Somebody looks into the room. The swastika, look at it. It's going around. It's not the twisted cross. It's the wheel of time. It specifically teaches a circular view of history. All these different views are antithetical to the biblical idea of a linear history that's going somewhere. And so you'd have this resurrection and death, but it was a cyclical spirituality. And so death and meaninglessness and despair have the final word. The Christian resurrection is a triumph over that system by one God that stands over it. There's an utter difference between the Christian idea of resurrection and these other myths. Any questions whatsoever on the Greek and Jewish context or why we even spent so much time on this? Because we're not yet after Christ in our Second Church history. I thought we'd start at Pentecost, maybe. But I think this is very, very important to do in the first week, because this is the soil into which Christ plants his church.
You said that the resurrection cracks Greek history. How so?
Greek history was at least cyclical in that sense. One author even called it a tragic view of history. So, in other words, the idea is that everything that's happened, in one sense, has happened. And the idea that history even evolved, emerged in Greece in Herodotus and Thucydides is kind of miraculous, because the idea of the myth and the idea of everything just repeating itself and that cynical idea that you're never going to get out of that, this is just the way it is kind of stuff. Even people that existed within that didn't really believe it. They couldn't. You can't live your life thinking that there's nothing more than this.
So you're not talking about like Greek history actually repeating itself. That's just how they view it.
Right. In general, the idea of history as a thing is a cyclical thing, ultimately.
There's the Greek mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
I can see how the resurrection might destroy that.
Yeah. There's an end to it, and it's a personal end. It's an intentional end. And that's another thing. Let me say this in a balanced way here. In the same way that the law prepared the Jew and made the Jew look forward to Christ, so the Logos pointed the Greek forward to Christ. One's general revelation. So I'm by no means giving the Greek any credit for that, any more than if fire had fallen into their lap. And that's another thing about defending Western history in church history. I'm really, in one sense, I'm not. I don't credit European man for superior ideas. But fire fell into his lap. The fact that he waved it around and burned a lot of people and used it for his own purposes is testimony to the sin of man. European man, Chinese man, Indian man, African man, all sinful. But the fact is, in God's inscrutable plan, he brought truth through Europe in a way, for his own purposes, that is a superior truth to the truth that just stays cyclical on general revelation. Something from up top invaded. And I think that's the main thesis to the whole that I'm doing in church history here. The whole thing and the whole driving force here is this big idea thesis that ideas matter, that truth changes the world, and that everything flows from the invisible to the visible, from the top down, from God to his creation. That's just monotheism. I have a monotheistic idea of church history, and I think most authors don't. So I intend to defend that throughout the next couple weeks.